Hello, curiosity seekers. Welcome to Dissecting Medical History. I'm Ange. I'm a travel nurse, medical history enthusiast, and your host. If you're looking for a storytelling formatted podcast with fun and fascinating topics on history and bios, then you are in the right spot. Please note this is not in any way medical advice. If you have anything that's ever discussed in any of the podcast episodes, please seek medical attention. Now, let's get this story started. Hello. Today I am with my friend Viv again. Hello, Viv.
Hi. Happy today, to be back.
Yeah, I'm glad you're back. I enjoy having you on my podcast. You are delightful and you bring good insight and you're very thought-provoking. And I like having you.
Yay, thank you.
It's better than being alone. I'm just kidding.
Oh no. That's the last part. Segment, right? We're gonna talk about loneliness.
Well, yes, today's topic is lonely. No, I'm gonna start by telling you about this 19-year-old ambitious journalist named Nellie.
Oh wow, 19. Oh my goodness.
Only 19, yeah. She was a journalist, 1887. I'm gonna tell you the story first and then we'll talk about her. I'm going to kind of do, normally I do biographies, I do the background first, but we're going to just jump in. She did what's called investigative journalism. She was kind of like the person who started that. And this put her on the map. Mm. So she was 19 and she went to this newspaper and said, I need a job. I want to do this article on immigration into this country, the U.S. And 1887, if you remember our Mary, the Typhoid Mary episode that we did, that's mm-hmm. around the time when millions of immigrants were coming to this country. So mm-hmm. it's a huge time between the late 1800s, early 1900s, where immigrants were coming, right? Mm-hmm. So she wanted to do an article on the immigration experience. And they're like, no, but how about you get yourself admitted into a lunatic asylum? I'm like, okay. And being this girl who's ambitious and wanted a job and
like, how did they come up with that? They're like, I had a nightmare yesterday and I want to see how this goes.
I think that there was reports of people that were being put in these asylums wrongly or when they got out, they were, so there was stories that were coming out and I think they wanted to do more investigation. She was already doing investigative reporting and I'll talk about that later in her biography. So this isn't new for her. It's new for the way journalism was being done. Mm-hmm. And so the way her resume was showing this, so she agreed to do it. So this is the late 1800s. They wanted her to go to New York's most notorious mental asylums. Now, the wording that I'm going to use a lot in this is not PC today, mm-hmm. like lunatics, crazy, that kind of thing. We don't use that terminology anymore. Her reporting was called 10 Days in a Madhouse. We don't use that anymore, mm-hmm. but that's the wording they used back then. So just an FYI to the listeners, I'm not trying to offend anybody. This is just how they reported it back then. So in order to get herself ready to go to this asylum, she was saying she didn't really know anybody who was a lunatic or crazy. So she just went by what she thought was crazy or crazy behavior. So she would practice in the mirror, like holding her eyes open without blinking. And making weird faces, trying to be as melancholy as possible, trying to be real sad. That was the most she was trying to, like, she was thinking was crazy. Crazy mm-hmm. behavior is like being sad and telling people she was lonely and all that. Mm-hmm. So her plan was to go into this boarding house for working women. She went in as a sane person, said she needed a room for a night. She didn't have any luggage or anything with her. She just went and said, I need a room. They let her have a room And the funny thing was she was describing in her report that it wasn't very nice looking, and like it wasn't very, so this girl is not exactly, I mean, she's a working girl and she probably has some high expectations, but the first chapter she was just describing this boarding house. And I think she described this boarding house as just being really sad and plain, and the food was not good. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking that's really funny because wait till she gets to the asylum.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like she's describing all this stuff and I'm like, yeah, okay, just wait. Mm-hmm. That's bad. But she changed her behavior while she was there. She started being real blunt, like telling people the food wasn't good. She's like, I don't want that food. It doesn't taste good. Or she started saying, I think these other women are really crazy. I think everybody's crazy. And then she stayed up all night, like just, I don't know if she was like sitting in the bed. She's just wide awake trying to, like, she was kind of freaking out the other people. And, but it wasn't doing anything. She was staying awake. But she was making other comments, like she was sad and melancholy and that kind of crap. Then the next day she like stepped it up a little bit and was talking about not wanting to leave. She wanted her trunks. Like just saying kind of things that didn't make sense. But they called the police to get her to, they said she was scaring the other people. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, okay, this doesn't seem insane to me. Mm-hmm. Like that's not something in our time. It doesn't seem insane. So, but they still called the cops. And because someone said she's insane, that just carried on, and that was just the assumption after that.
I thought she was going to get in by, you know, having somebody admit her.
No, she, like
somebody
she
was working trying to, with her.
So, no, she, that's what I thought too, but she got herself admitted. And it turns out it's extremely easy to get admitted back in the 1800s into an asylum. Hmm. It's extremely easy. And you don't have to, someone else could admit you. So there was people that she had met that got admitted for, like one girl, she was ill and she went to this place called a sister's home, which is kind of like, it's not a hospital, but it's like a convalescent where you just go to get better. But her family couldn't afford it. So they transferred her to the insane asylum. They had, mm-hmm. they just admitted her. She wasn't insane. She wasn't mentally disabled at all. They just couldn't afford her care.
Yeah.
And that was a story after story. And so that was really easy. It's like, it's super easy.
Hmm.
So anyway, so she went with the police to the police station, and she was playing it up. Like she pretended like she was from Cuba, that she gave a fake name. She kept saying she wanted her trunks and she was being pleasant. She wasn't acting out at all. Like if I was going to try to get into an insane asylum, I feel like I'd have to step it up with some really insane, like, behavior, but not just say, I don't know where I'm from. And she started acting like she couldn't remember things. Like she couldn't remember where she was from at first. She couldn't remember anything. She acted like she had no memory. Like she had no, like she had amnesia.
Yeah. It sounds like she just was going the route of being a nuisance, and that was enough for them.
Yeah. And it was, but so she went in front of a judge who, I guess that was the way it was. They bring you in and they would see a judge. The judge was like, I think maybe someone gave her some drugs or something, which could be someone could have slipped her something and she just didn't know what was happening. And he almost was just going to take her to the hospital. But then was talking about this whole memory thing and was trying to play it up a little bit more. And so the judge did end up saying, okay, we'll just take her to Bellevue to be examined.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the thing is, you would think, okay, they're going to take her to Bellevue. Bellevue is famous. It does have a famous mental institute. They would evaluate her. And if they were good, like this judge thinks they would be, they could determine whether she was insane or not. You're putting it on someone else to make that determination. It's not the judge's job anyway. He's not a mental doctor. However, he underestimated the doctors at that time because none of them tested her for real sanity. So they took her to Bellevue and they just went on the assumption she was insane because that's where they sent her. And they just asked her questions like, where are you from? Are you a prostitute? Are you, you know, are you married? Things like that. And because she was trying to get into the insane asylum, Bellevue is just the first step. She was pretending still to not have a memory and all that. She was pleasant, nice, whatever, cooperative to extent. And then they sent her to the Blackwell Institute. The Blackwell, it's called Blackwell Island Lunatic Asylum. So she spent a day at Bellevue and wrote about that. She complained about the food and it was extremely cold. They didn't give them anything to keep warm. The nurses were not very nice, except for one. The one nice nurse asked for money, asked if she had any pennies. They would give them really disgusting food, and the doctor evaluated her, didn't ask her proper questions. They just kind of asked her things like, you know, again, where is she from? Are you a prostitute kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
While she was there at the Bellevue, she was put on display by reporters. So reporters would find out someone was coming in because she didn't know, they didn't know who she was and whatnot. They let them go through her clothes and look at her. Now she's a reporter. She's a journalist. So she was really scared that she was going to be found out. So she was trying to hide her face and everything, but they didn't find out who she was, but they did, like I said, go through her clothes and things and try to figure out who she was. The nurses told the reporters what they knew of her. And they told them, I don't know, whatever information that they had. And then they did put it in the newspaper. They did report. So total HIPAA violation. Like, like that would never happen today, telling a reporter why someone was there or whatever. But that's what they did. They completely, you know, against patient confidentiality.
They knew she was a journalist, or they found out who she was?
No, they didn't at that time. But there was someone that had come to visit at some point that she knew, because reporters were coming in and out of the hospital, both of them, I guess. And she did recognize someone from the next place. She kind of stopped it in its tracks so he wouldn't give her away. So he knew her, but so he just pretended like, oh, no, I don't know this person.
Hmm.
But for the most part, I mean, it wasn't like she was a well-known journalist at this point yet. So most of the reporters, she didn't know them. My point is that that's what they would do. They would come in and try to see these new people. Sometimes they would come in to see if there was a missing person, they would go into the asylum looking for them. Like maybe they got put in there on accident or whatnot. You know what I mean? Because like I said, it's easy to get in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so she met this girl there that I told you about, that her name was Miss Tilly. She was sent there because of her family not being able to afford anything. And then that poor girl, she was still kind of ill, but she ended up going with her to the Blackwell Island as well. The new asylum was pretty large, very cold. She said that one of the doctors had told her there's about 1,600 patients there, 1,600 women. The doctors didn't spend very much time with the patients. And then when they did, they just kept asking the same questions over and over, like, where are you from? What's your name? And she said that a lot of them would tell them, I'm not insane. Please test me. Do your test. You know, prove that I'm not, or that I am, or whatever. And the doctors would say, no, you're already declared insane. We don't need to do these tests.
Hmm.
Yeah. Some of the people there, some of the women may have had a breakdown at some point. There was one lady that was admitted at the end who had been a cook and was cleaning the kitchen, and somebody came in and was messed it up on purpose. So she lost her temper. They took her and admitted her to the asylum
mm-hmm.
for having a bad temper.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot imagine. I would probably be in an asylum 10 times over by now if it was like based on anger. So
yeah, that's so and I know, it's just like, especially if there's like how people are supposed to act, and if that's a women like type of thing, like you gotta, if you're a female,
so you act a certain way. One of the things that I thought about when I was reading this is the fact that there's probably a lot more women than there are men here, because again, it's so easy to admit your wife, like maybe you're tired of her, you want a divorce, you're seeing someone else. All you have to do is say she's insane.
Yeah. And that men first put them in prison. They could be, the men would go to prison instead of insane asylum.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, you know, if you lost your temper, even if you didn't hurt anybody or whatever, you're not going to put a man in jail, because that's what men do.
True. Like the I guess the range would be a lot more, whereas like they would have to do a tolerance. Lot more. The tolerance. Yeah, that's good.
So, okay. Back in the day, long time ago, when I worked in construction, I was considered a bitch all the time, because I would ask somebody to do something. Okay. A guy could ask somebody to do something and then they wouldn't be considered that, right? Mm-hmm. I have certain expectations. I'm expecting the plumbing to be done by a certain date. Can you please do it? Okay, mm-hmm. Well, that sounds rude, right? But if a guy had said that, they wouldn't be considered rude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly the same thing, but it's the same as far as men get away with a lot more. And I'm just pointing out that it's probably very unfair that a lot of these women were put in here for unacceptable reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For unacceptable reasons. And it's maddening, to have a pun in there, that that is so, it's so unfair. It's so unfair. In this new asylum too, like I said, the doctors spent very little time with them, and they would wake them up in the middle of the night. I don't know if they were bored or what, but the doctors would come ask them questions, or women weren't allowed to sleep. Like the nurses would come in and bug them during the night, or they would make a lot of noise outside.
And sleep is so important, and we're just like finding that out right now too.
Yeah, sleep is extremely important, but they didn't get to sleep. And the first at Bellevue, she said that the doors were locked from the outside. The doors are locked on the outside on this place too. But at Bellevue, I think she had her own room for safety, because they didn't know how crazy she really was or whatever. They cut their nails real short, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But in the Blackwell, there was a lot more people in a room. She said one of the patients would not go to sleep. She would just be wandering around looking for someone she was trying to kill. And that's kind of scary. Yeah, like, how are you going to go to sleep if you're feeling like you could be killed at any moment?
Yeah.
Now, Nellie already didn't want to go to sleep because she wanted not to miss anything, because she was trying to report on things. She had a little book that she was writing things in. And at first, her little book didn't make sense because she didn't want people to get it and then think, oh, she's a reporter and writing all this stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
She was writing things down, names and stuff, so she wouldn't forget them. But she wasn't writing her story quite yet. But mm-hmm. one of the nurses, she took it away, and the pencil. She told the doctor, look, I want my book back. And then the nurse finally gave it back, but not the pencil, and was kind of gaslighting her, like, well, you never had a pencil.
Oh, no.
That kind of thing. So, but this nurse was really mean. The main nurse, she was very cruel to the other patients. They would slap them, knock them around, beat them. One patient was choked in the closet, and they didn't do it out there in the open. They would take them somewhere else and do it. Mm-hmm. She said they would took this lady into a closet, choked her, and she ended up having hand marks for the rest of the day. Patients wouldn't be tested, like I said. There was one instance where, well, in the beginning, when she was first there at the new asylum, where the doctor was flirting with the nurse. And then while he was trying to do this evaluation, like, they were weighing her and how tall is she, and they were flirting back and forth. And he said, what was the newspaper reporting? Did they report on her? And they said, yeah, but then he couldn't find the reporting. but he was trying to find what they said about her so they could put it in her evaluation.
Wow.
So the reporters that went to the first asylum in Bellevue to write about her, like they were trying to find out information, but the nurses there were the ones that were telling the reporters about her. So that's mm-hmm. how they're getting their information about her, is like the secondhand reporting from the reporters. It was just crazy. There was a patient there that didn't speak English. I think she spoke German, and they didn't even have an interpreter. She didn't know why she was there. They didn't tell her why she was there.
Oh, and
they didn't do anything about it. And she wasn't the only one. There was a lot of patients there that were of other nationalities or other languages, and they didn't do anything.
They're just like, this person speaking gibberish. Right. Instead of like the next really,
they just yell obvious. At them, you're here in the madhouse and you're not gonna get out forever.
I don't know, like I've seen it firsthand with like my mom, you know, speaks, her main language is Spanish, so yeah, people sometimes get louder thinking that it's and that was like, this or is a slower long yeah louder or slower, and it's like, I guess it's the same thing with like any
I know I've done it. I don't know why it's like that knee-jerk reaction when you're trying to like talk to someone who's, I mean, I get the slower part because you're like trying to enunciate more, but it doesn't make it interpreted any
maybe it's such a quick reaction, because I think the only time that someone can't hear you is that they're far away, or they can't, you're thinking that they can't understand you, and you relate it to not being able to hear you. So maybe that's why the voice goes louder. Yeah.
Well, so I work in a hospital, which I, you know, and sometimes we do have people that are really deaf, and this is kind of off the subject, but I'll go and I'll talk to this patient and I'll be yelling at them. And then all of a sudden I go to another patient. I'm still yelling.
Oh no. Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm yelling.
Straight to the asylum. Believe it or not, straight to the asylum.
Anyway. Okay. Yeah. So that was over and over. There was patients that were like that. And it's just really sad that they couldn't find an interpreter or whatnot. The patient that spoke German, the nurse spoke a little German, I guess. And the doctor was like, just tell her this. And she's like, I don't speak German. And he goes, yes, you do. And she said, she asked her something about, where's your husband? And he goes, see, you spoke German. But that was it. They didn't say, you know, she didn't try to interpret like, you know, your husband sent you here, you're never getting out. And they would say that over and over. The nurses and doctors would tell these patients they're not getting out.
Wow.
They just, so you know, like,
yeah, they're making people crazy. Lack of sleep, unsafe environment. Listening.
And I'm going to go on. It gets worse.
Oh my gosh.
The food was horrible. The bread she said she had, they put butter on it. She said the butter was really gross. They said the other patients were, you can ask for it without butter. So she did. And then there was a bug in her bread. Mm. They'd give them watered down tea, prunes for lunch. No actual like food, bread and water, bread and tea. They were given one bath a week. The water was not changed in between patients until it was thick. Once the water was thick and gross, then they would drain the tub, but they wouldn't clean the tub. Mm-hmm. They were only given soap on that one day. They had to share towels. There's like 40 of them, and there's like 3 towels or something crazy. They only got their clothes changed like once a month, unless a patient had a visitor, then they would hurry and get the patient clean clothes as to not give a bad impression.
Ugh. Do you think that these people like actually believe that they were like the patients or like the doctors or the staff, do you think that they believe that the patients were mentally ill, or do you think that they knew?
I think yes, in a way, because someone else told them that they were.
Okay. And so it's a case of like treating somebody as if they're less than human kind of thing instead of.
Right. And I think that's the case, because I'm going to get into some of the cruelty, but for instance, someone said Nellie was insane. So the policeman believed it. The judge started to believe it. Bellevue believed it. The next asylum believed it. No one ever questioned it. And they just assumed, okay, because someone else labeled them insane, they're insane. And they, like I said, they went to go ask for a test to say, okay, well, prove that I'm insane. And they said, well, you've already been determined. We don't need
to. Yeah, I really don't want to put in more effort. Like, this is really efficient for me to just say that you're insane.
Right. And I don't know why the doctors didn't care more or not. I don't know. I don't know why they just didn't. But the nurses didn't either. And they treated them like they were less. They were not human. They just assumed. Some of the nurses would tell them, because they didn't give them any extra blankets or clothing, they would just tell them that they were in.
Okay. Yeah.
In charity cases.
I think, so I was thinking like part of it was like resentful, like that the staff was like resentful of the people. But another way to think of it is if everybody's say you're in this environment and you're seeing that these people are treated a certain way, you want to believe that they deserve it. That's like another part, like, because I think like not every solution or.
What do you mean by deserve it? Like
you want to.
Like they were a prisoner and they, because they had bad behavior, they deserve to be.
Yeah. Like, or because they're less than human, they deserve this type of treatment because they see that it's being done to them. So, and what would happen to you? Like, as a person, like, are you yourself? Like, wouldn't you think, oh, this person is hurting? Or what if this was me? They don't see themselves or they don't see their family in these people. They're just seeing that, you know, maybe that is.
They're like a minority, like they would treat like a slave or like a minority. Like they're not.
Like, there's whole like belief systems that believe that like you're born into this system, this caste system. And like, it's so much easier to believe that this is your fault. All your suffering is your fault. And then otherwise you just kind of.
Yeah. Because she said a lot of the people that she was talking about were pretty sane. She says there were the people that were acting out. They would talk to themselves. They would, you know, were acting out as if they were mentally disturbed. But there was a lot of patients that were there that were not. She said they were rational, sane people that she could have full conversations with that didn't seem like they needed to be there at all. But she knew that because she put away her bias and was there as an observer. Whereas these nurses were treating everybody like they were all crazy, insane, and below them.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they got that mentality. I don't know. The one thing that makes me wonder is like that Stanford study where there was prisoners and guards, and the guards started treating the prisoners.
That's a really poorly. It's a really famous study, but I want to say that that it came out later that it was acting. I want to say like only in the last several like few years, like in the last couple years, maybe that they said that it actually wasn't, that there were some people playing it up. And so I know the study, and I was really surprised that was said, that it was actually somebody being an actor.
So. Yeah. But then the actor, I heard that too, but then other people follow along.
Yeah.
So like Miss Grady is the worst nurse in this story. She's the worst. And then other people kind of follow along because it's like they don't want to be different or rock the boat or be that. I mean, they're going along with it. They get caught up in all of that.
Yeah.
And Nellie said there was only one nurse that was nice. Yeah. But they do get to be a culture.
Yeah. And like I said, not every explanation works for every, like any convincing, like how to reach or understand a person. Like for one example, I was saying like some people might think of that they deserve it. Another type of person who might be treating them bad might be resentful. But another one would be if you're
it's like that mentality, like when you're young and you're living at home, you think that that's the whole world. And if you're working and you're there so many hours of the day, you think this is the whole world, and you rely on the system that's in place. You don't want to step out of bounds. You don't want to do anything different. So you just go along with everything because that's just how it is.
Yeah. But this has been going on. I mean, the treatment in this sane asylums have been going on for thousand years or so. I mean, hundreds and hundreds, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like they've been treating the mentally ill poorly for a long time. Mm-hmm. So even if you got a good nurse in there or several good nurses in there, the culture really has to be overturned. Yeah. And the mentality has to be changed because it's been going on for so long. It's really sad, but that was the reality. And the whole thing about this, her going in here and shedding a light on this stuff was to put it in the newspaper, was to shine a light on what was going on. So we'll talk about that too in a little bit. So back to the nurses and their cruelty. Speaking of all of that, they did tell the patients that they were charity cases. They weren't getting anything better. They were never getting out. They weren't allowed to do anything. They didn't have anything to read. They had a piano, I know, at Bellevue, and people would sing and stuff, but then the nurses just would get upset and just tell them to shut up.
Oh, no chance of happiness at all.
And the chairs and the benches they had were extremely uncomfortable. They were allowed to go outdoors at some point during the day. They all had to be in line to walk. She'd mentioned that on the wall, there was a thing that said, "While I live, I hope," which she thought was inappropriate and not true at this point because it was very, there was like the all hope was like sucked out of that place. You get there and you know, like, you're never leaving. They keep telling you you're never leaving. So where's the hope in that? Like, your days are all the same. And in fact, she was like, reported, she was there for 10 days. She said, "I'm not even going to report on every single day. They were all the same." She just highlighted certain things that had happened. So it's pretty depressing if you think about it. She said that the prisoners in the jail were treated, and she did a piece on a prison because she told one of the doctors about the fire hazard, about the doors are locked from the outside. If there was a fire, they would be all doomed because the nurses aren't going to come and unlock each door. They're going to flee. Mm-hmm. So she said they should have a system where there's a lock at the end that they could unlock, so all the doors are open at the same time in case of a fire. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Well, how do you know of such locks?" And she's like, "I just know. I've seen one when I visited someone mm-hmm. in prison." And she did do a piece of journalism on a prison in New York. So that's how she mm-hmm. knew. But she didn't want to give herself away. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so that was kind of funny. But that was one of her things, was like, there's fire safety issues. The outside, they were allowed to walk, but they weren't allowed to like move off and go under the grass or do anything different. They weren't allowed to do anything except maybe make clothes. Like, they had to sew their own clothes. They cleaned. The nurses did nothing. She said that they would have the patients doing all the scrubbing and cleaning. She said that the nurses got food from the kitchen, like apples and fruit and stuff that the patients weren't allowed to have. They weren't even allowed to have fresh fruit, but the nurses would eat in front of the patients, and their patients were always hungry and always really cold. Like I said, they were cruel. They would hurt people, tell people to shut up in the worst units, which she didn't go to. Her plan was to try to get to some of the more violent wards to take a look at those. But after the stories that some of the patients had told her about, she didn't want to risk her health and safety to do that, which I don't blame her. And she said she didn't want to risk her health or her hair, because a lot of times they pulled out their hair. Yeah. Like, the nurses would pull it out to the point where it wouldn't even grow back. It would be like patches of bald spots. Jeez. So she's like, "Yeah, I kind of don't want to go through that. So she didn't do that part. But after everything was said and done, they did come and get her. The lawyer got her out. They didn't just come and say, oh, she's a reporter. Just kidding. She didn't really need to be here. She had to actually get the lawyer from the newspaper that came and got her. So she had to go to a grand jury to like say she really wasn't insane. So this is the interesting part. Well, she was working with a district attorney on the things that she'd found. In that grand jury, she was telling them about all the things that had happened. Her story was in the newspaper. It was done in 6 parts. And the jury, I think there was like 20 jurors. They wanted to go and see the asylum. So they went. Someone had leaked it and they had an hour's notice. Dang. Mm-hmm. They went on the boat to the island, and it's kind of an interesting island. It's a real thin little island in New York. But you had to get to it by boat. I'm sure there's bridges by now, but the boat was different. It was a different boat. She said it was completely clean. She didn't smell and have like it wasn't the same boat. And they said, oh, that boat's getting repaired. The patients that she had talked about in her paper were all missing. They said, oh, they've been transferred, or they denied that any of them existed. Like there was one woman that was a Mexican woman. She said they just denied she existed. Jeez. Like Nellie had made it up. They had cleaned everything. They had the kitchen. Everything was clean. Everything was like the beds were all better. Everything was like the first beds were made of straw.
Mm-hmm.
At least at Bellevue. I don't know what the beds were like in the other hospital, the main one that she was at. But everything was changed. It was like they had this heads up and then they fixed everything. But they did get to talk to Nellie. Nellie was the one that I told you about, that she was there because of her family. And she was pretty sane. When she left, she said she was ill.
Do you mean
Tilly? And that Tilly. Okay. Sorry, not yeah. Tilly. She was ill when she left, but she said she looked really ill when she came back. She said that at the end of those 10 days that she was starting to get a little delirious, like a little paranoid. And I can imagine if you're stuck there, no food, and you're beaten, or you have nothing to do, that you would go insane. Mm-hmm. That it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say you're insane and you just act insane, then you're going to end up insane. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, but she did corroborate that, yeah, we came in together. This place was awful. The food was awful. The beds were awful. It was so cold. And she said that Nellie kept asking for warmer clothes. And she said, and as soon as Nellie left, and the thing was in the newspaper about what happened, they did get more clothing and more warm blankets and stuff. Mm. So things changed a little bit, but I think it was just temporary because maybe the investigation.
Yeah.
So the district attorney was able to help. They got more, the judge ordered more funding so they could have better treatment. They could have better food and better, have more stuff that could help keep them warm, that kind of thing. They addressed the fire hazard. I don't think that there was enough. I mean, at least it was addressed, but I don't think there was enough. I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah. Like you said, it's a culture thing, to target the culture. And there's only so much. We're learning so much now about, psychology and stuff just in the last years. Like, there's so many different fields of science that we're just now getting good information.
Oh, yeah. From. Well, even back in 1887, they didn't know mental health. It was still very new.
Yeah.
So them saying, well, let me look at your eyes, stick out your tongue, that doesn't really talk too much about your sanity. But the other thing was the doctor had told her when she saw him, because they asked, why didn't you know that the nurses were treating the patients like this? Why didn't you know they were being this cruel? why didn't you know they were so cold? And he goes, they didn't tell me. But the thing is, if you told on the nurses, they would retaliate with beatings and stuff like that. Like one of the girls ended up going to the doctor with a black eye, and the doctor said, did she get this from the outside? And they said, yes. Well, that wasn't true. The nurse gave her the black
eye. Yeah, we're just now getting to laws about like protecting whistleblowers, and that's only us.
Yeah.
There's not any, right. You know, that mentality is still like.
Yeah. So the whole retaliation thing was there, and the doctors were not supportive, but part of the change that they were supposed to do with Nellie's reporting was to get better education with the nurses. And he even said one of the nurses, they dismissed because they found out she was being very cruel, but that was one nurse out of, you know, however many there were.
Yeah.
So as a nurse, I cannot imagine treating a patient like that. I couldn't. Sometimes you do, like, especially you get those patients that are just assholes and you want to punch them in the face, but you don't.
Like, you, I don't just, know. I want to believe that. But know? After all that stuff, it's like, oh, you know, like,
I've been punched and hit and stuff, but I have never just can't even imagine.
Oh, I mean, like, like in an environment where everybody's doing a certain thing, like we want to believe that we would be different, or we wouldn't be the worst of them. We'd be, you know,
but yeah, we
don't know.
We would independently,
unfortunately,
we would independently think our behavior would be different than them.
Actually,
yeah,
like, that's actually a really important thing to acknowledge, to even just consider the fact that we might be susceptible to that kind of behavior if we're in that environment. Like just to acknowledge that can help prevent you from acting a certain way if you ever find yourself in a situation where everybody like is in groupthink. Like if you think that you are that can't be you, you're more closer to being that way. Just with that idea, like just with that mindset of I could never do that. Like it's okay to think just a one. There's just a point 0.09.
Yeah, right. It's easy because I don't know anybody who would do that either.
Yeah, we think we don't, but just the fact that there have been like there are just horrible things done on a massive scale in different parts of the world, in different parts of time.
Yeah. That's true.
Oh, and something I was thinking at the beginning, I think before we started recording, I was like, because you were like, well, imagine if, you know, you're in her shoes or anybody's shoes and like what they're going through. And I was like, well, that's hard to imagine, like to be a investigative journalist, because I wouldn't do that. Right. You know, like I wouldn't want to go into a madhouse. Right. But that's actually,
yeah,
because at that time they didn't have the movies and the scary movies telling us back when she actually like brought that out, like, hey, this is the horrible stuff going on. They really didn't know. So I was like, she's the first of her time, like, or, you know, one of the first stories to actually go in and communicate it to, I guess, modern people. And so, yeah, that's why I'm like, I'm so cautious against something like that, is because of, you know, like this is 100+ years later.
Yeah. She, even though there were stories coming out of these asylums, you're right. She didn't know exactly what was happening until she had to go in. And like I said before, when she was going to that boarding house, this was like appalled by it because their pictures on the wall were cheap. Like that's like nothing. Yeah. You're going to an asylum and you're actually expecting an asylum to treat people for their mental illness, and they're not.
Yeah.
She didn't know any of that. You're right. That would be hard. But my thing is, if I was going into an asylum, knowing, okay, maybe I could do it with the unknown. However, I would be so scared that lawyer would never come back and get me.
And then you'd start to think, wait, I think I was crazy the whole time. I have dreams where I'm convinced that those things are real. I'm like, well, you know, you could second guess anything.
There was a time she wrote when she was like staring out the window, and she's like, I know that I'll be able to get out, but then what if I don't?
Yeah. Oh, of course.
And then she had guilt leaving because she left. She said goodbye to these people, mm-hmm. and she's leaving them to this fate, like knowing that some of them shouldn't even be there.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's really scary to think you can get there. You can get stuck very easily. That would be my fear.
Yeah.
That she's pretty ballsy. I mean, and when I get to her bio, she is pretty ballsy. She's done.
Oh, some... after the fact, after she went in. Yeah. Well, that's probably because mm-hmm. the face, it's like conditioning. Like you faced your fears or you've seen a really bad part of humanity. You lived through it. So now you can
get for it. No. Well, I mean, she's just an explorer anyway. She's just a very adventurous person. Yeah,
that's true.
But anyway, so she did help make these changes and stuff. And I don't know, again, like how successful that was. It's not like mental hospitals now are much better than they used to be. There's a lot more regulations and inspections, but there weren't inspections back then. I'm pretty sure because you researched it as well and couldn't find anything.
I don't think they would want to really, I don't think that's something that would be easily shared or kept track of. Everything I found was like kind of recent, but I did find some of the different laws that were created or different acts, but.
There's a podcast called Consistently Eccentric. They are a podcast across the pond in England. And he did a podcast on Bedlam. And Bedlam is not too different than Bellevue in that it's a very old asylum and it went on for hundreds of years. And he did a podcast on it. And it was pretty bad. It was pretty interesting. He was talking about how, in fact, there was one family that had been a director of it for so long, the Monroes, and they pretty much were just collecting the money, but they didn't do any of the work. And so if people are interested, they should go and look up Consistently Eccentric podcast and look that up because it was really interesting. And they had no regulations as well and no inspections, even though the government were supposed to be doing inspections, they didn't. And I'm not exactly sure how much regulations or inspections they were doing here because it doesn't seem like they were. Mm-hmm. If they got heads up, obviously, if you're being inspected, you're not going to be beating the patients. And it's so easy to say, oh, she got a black eye on the outside. We didn't do that on the inside. She just gotten here and things like that. Or she fell down or whatever. And of course, they're not going to believe the patients. They're insane. Why would they be telling the truth? Of course we give them baths. Of course we give them clothes. You know what I mean? So it's so easy to blame the patients. And so I don't know how much was being done at that time. And I know in the hospital setting, we have people that come in from the state or certain places like JCO that will come in and do regular, inspections. And we're always given heads up. They always like report on the speaker or people come running, JCO's here, hide your flushes. And it's so dumb that like flushes and things, so those silly things are what's so important when in a place like this mental asylum, the important thing is like giving them good food or decent food or nutritious food, proper food.
Just not waking them up at night, maybe. Maybe there's no yelling and maybe don't pull their hair out violently.
Yeah. So anyway, so let me tell you her background really quick. It's not too much. Nellie was born Elizabeth Jane Cochran in 1864 in the town of Cochran in Pennsylvania. Her father founded the town. That's why it's called Cochran, Pennsylvania. He was a lawyer and a landowner with a thriving mill. However, when he died, he had no will. So the family and all the children couldn't support themselves after that, and they were forced to move. They did go and work at a boarding house, which Nellie helped her mom take care of. And that's probably why she was so judgmental in her book about her story about the boarding house.
Yeah, it sounds like privilege and then actually
right. Like she knows what a good boarding house is. But to be fair, the place that she went to go stay at before she went to the asylum was for working women, and it was a temporary home. So it wasn't like, you know, a hotel or something is supposed to be all nice. Nellie went to Indiana's Teachers College, but she had to drop out because of money. And that's when she changed her name and added an E on the end of it. I don't know why. So when she was at home, she was reading this newspaper called the Pittsburgh Dispatch. And they had been writing things like, women are best served by conducting domestic duties, and called the working women a monstrosity. And this was really upsetting to Nellie. So she wrote a response to the paper about the negative representation of women. And not only did they print her response in the paper, they actually offered her a job as a columnist, giving her $5 a week. Her column became very popular, and it was geared towards women, but it did focus on the negative consequences of sexist ideologies and the importance of women and their rights. It was at this time, too, that she was doing some undercover exposés on the poor working conditions of women in sweatshops. So that's kind of her lead in to the investigative reporting that I was talking about earlier. She wanted to do more than just pieces for women. So she ended up moving to New York in 1886, found it very difficult to find jobs as a newspaper woman. She did do that piece on the jail, and she did some other pieces as well. But the one with the asylum made her famous. And she ended up being very well known and can pretty much write her ticket for other pieces. She read that book, The 80 Days Around the World. Was it called 80 Days Around the World? She got the newspaper to fund her to do it, and she did it in 72 days. She broke the record. So she wrote a thing on that as well. So after that experience, she became very well known as an investigative journalist, and she went on to do some other things like her experience in Mexico and as a foreign correspondent. She wrote other pieces about like Susan B. Anthony and a woman named Emma Goldman, who was an anarchist political philosopher. I had to look up Emma Goldman. I heard of her, but I didn't really know her very well. But one of her quotes I really liked, it says, "The most violent element in society is ignorance." I thought that was pretty profound. Yeah. In 1895, Nellie married a millionaire by the name of Robert Seaman, who was 40 years older than she was. He owned a business called the Ironclad Manufacturing Company. And so she retired from journalism. And then he died in 1903, not too long after they were married. And she ended up running the company. She was left this massive company. She got several patents while she was working there, one of which is a 55-gallon steel oil drum that's apparently still used today. And she started doing things at the business that was like employee perk type things, like she got a fitness center, a library, and healthcare. Then those things started to drain the inheritance that was left to her. So she did start going back to journalism. And she was covering things like the women's suffrage and World War I until she died in 1922 at the age of 57. So she is a very interesting woman, very courageous. The picture of her, she looks very innocent and cute and young, like just a sweet person. So I think it'd be easy for her to get in to do these investigative things like the sweatshop. I think she also did a piece on working women or getting a job from one of those. It's like a temp agency type place where you go in and you're like, I need a job. All right. Do you want to be a chambermaid? Yes, please. So that kind of thing. So yeah, that was Nellie. Her full name is Nellie Cochran, but she went by Nellie Bly when she went into the newspaper business. I forgot to mention that. So her name to everybody is Nellie Bly. In the insane asylum, she went by Nellie Brown and said she was from Cuba, which was really random. But anyway, yeah. So what'd you think?
Yeah, very, it's super interesting. Of course, like I said, the seeing all the movie references, like there's, I don't know if you've ever watched the show Futurama, but there's a really great episode on being committed to, like the prison system, I think, is full. So they sentence the main character to a insane asylum. And they're like, well, the insane asylums are filled up too. So because you declared that being poor is a mental illness. And so he's like, okay, well, he'll go to the robot asylum. And so the character is in the robot asylum and they don't listen to him. He's like, I'm not a robot. And they're treating him like a robot. So in the end, he goes crazy. It's one of my favorite episodes. And it's like,
that's funny. I'll have to see it. I've never really watched Futurama.
Oh, it's really good.
I've seen a couple episodes, but no, I've never really. I think the guy's voice was annoying to me. I don't know.
Yeah, there's some really, like, there's some ones that won some awards, and they had, I believe their writers consisted of a lot of, like, the most PhDs or something like that. Like, a lot of the science, like,
oh, funny.
A lot of the episodes have, you know, theories and stuff based in science. And so, but yeah, that one, and there was some other, oh, like, one of my favorite horror movies, House on Haunted Hill, featured in getting stuck in an insane asylum. And so, like, of course, like, getting into this topic, I had all those references in my head because they're, you know, like we mentioned how, yeah, there had been stories that came out on why this was at the forefront. Like, it made sense for her to go undercover because it was coming out in different ways. Like, people were learning about it, so they were interested. But it is different to see a visual or have, like, some connection with the information. So like the House on Haunted Hills scared me as a little kid, shouldn't have watched it, but it's still one of my favorite movies. And so I'm like, yeah, that I have that visual that would prevent me from wanting to go into an insane asylum.
Well, I think, like, going back to Miss Tilly, if her family knew of the treatment that they sent her to, they might have tried harder to take care of her.
Well, hopefully, but
you would think, right? But there's probably a lot of people like that. You're not going to think of all of them trying to just get rid of their family member. But if they actually knew some of the treatment that was going on, they probably wouldn't be so, you know, it wouldn't be so easy for them to just get rid of people and put them in a place like this. Because to be honest, prisons treat them better than they do in an insane asylum, at least back then. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost, I mean, you get more freedom at least in prison. You know, if you didn't do, you know, a crime where you there for life or whatnot, that you have an end date. You can leave at some point, right? Yeah. Especially if you have good behavior. The food is probably not that much better, but at least there's probably a lot better treatment than there would
like,
be.
In like him. You said, like, maybe it's the culture. Maybe it's even like, so if you're a prisoner, maybe, or you work at a prison, maybe you were able to relate a little bit easier to somebody like, oh, they committed a certain crime and I could see myself doing that or whatever, but at least they don't do the subhuman type category. But if they're mentally insane or they believe or they're whatever it is, it's like, maybe that's why it was harsher because, you know, like, because, like, yeah, the prison system probably still had some harshness, but did it infect everything, like, the how everyone was treated? Whereas,
yeah. Anyway, it's a tough subject anyway, and I'm hoping to do another episode where we do talk more about mental illness and less about being stuck in a place where you should be treated and you don't have mental illness.
Yeah, and even now, mental illness is just becoming a nice little conversation, like, more open, more people. Like, I really did love that ignorance.
It's not as taboo.
Yeah, I love that that ignorance is the most violent quote that you did, or you said.
Yeah, well, on that note, On that note, I think we should say goodbye. And I appreciate you being with me again.
Yay, thanks.
We had a lot of deep conversation today.
Yeah, I love these kind of conversations. So yay, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it was a lot of thought provoking information. Yay. I think. So, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.
Bye.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed today's mental vacation from your current life. If you did and are curious for more, please subscribe. Before you go, if you have anything to add to today's show, or you have a topic that you think is worthy of dissection, please reach out on dissectingmedicalhistory.com or Instagram on dissectingmedicalhistory. Thank you, and stay curious.